I am just here, most of you know who I am, I'm Emily Buss. I am mostly just here to introduce the fine students. We'll be talking about the foster care project and workshop this year. So what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about how the project came about and the basic problem that we have been devoting a year trying to help solve. That's the ambition for the project. The way the project came about sort of started with the dean. When he became dean many years ago now, decided that it would be great if the law school was more involved in thinking about real life problems and coming up with solutions, proposals for change in the law that might help solve the problem. And he asked me if I would be interested in identifying the area that I thought was well suited for this kind of work and taking on a project around those aims. And I was enthusiastic. I come from a background doing public interest litigation and advocacy, and knew that in the areas that I worked, there were a lot of really interesting problems. Among them, the problem that I'll describe in a minute, which is getting a lot of attention among social scientists and people on the ground doing this kind of work these days, which is sort of looking particularly at foster care, more particularly. The experience of those who grow up in foster care, right, who neither go home to their birth families nor get adopted into other families, that end up in foster care until they do what's called age out of the system, meaning they get old enough to be recognized as adults, and the foster care system then discharges them. And the problem is, put very sort of simply, that they are very badly prepared to take on full responsibility for themselves in adulthood, and then are expected under the current legal regime to fully support themselves in a way that we don't expect other 18-year-olds to do. Right? So the experience of people growing up in their families of origin is that at 18 they have legal independence, they can make their own choices, they have legal authority to do so, but in fact, if you look at how people live, for the next at least 5-7 years, often much longer, there's ongoing financial and emotional dependence that is quite important and appropriate. It's not dysfunctional. It is how people go on to get further education, to try jobs, and if they don't work out, they have a second chance in their life. None of that is available in many states, and the states anything is available is a pretty modest version for foster youth who have, in fact, been less well prepared to take on that independence before they reach the age of 18. So it's really easy to identify a problem. You know, what do you say? Look at the outcomes. Foster youth in adulthood are much more likely to be homeless. They're much more likely to be very poor. They're much more likely to be sick and uninsured. They're much more likely to be arrested and incarcerated. They're much more likely to give birth to children before they're in a position to raise them, right? The kind of outcome, anything you look to, they're much less likely to be in school, continuing in education, graduating from high school, or getting a post-secondary education. So it's easy to see that there's a problem, and I have never met anybody who thinks there's not a problem. The question is, what do you do about it? And our challenge is really twofold. One is, what in particular needs to change in the law? I mean, it's sort of one of these things, and maybe this is just about putting a lot more money into providing support. So to what extent is there work to be done in thinking about how the law and the legal process could be changed? So that's one challenge that we have. And the other challenge was to think about how we, who are sitting in a law school, could hope to have any kind of influence over what happens in the real world, including how you change the law in the real world from our position, the fact that we're time limited and are involved in the life. That was a challenge as well, and really framed our work in terms of our segment. So this year, I have run what I call the workshop, or back of a kind of more precise word, 12 students who have been involved all year, committed to the project for the year. Very much the idea is that we're all in this together, we're equals in this collaborative effort. And in that spirit, I turn things completely over to 4 out of the 12, one-third of the workshop.
Can you introduce yourselves first and then start talking?
Sure.
Okay. You go first.
All right. I'm Anne. I'm a 2L.
I'm Sarah. I'm a 3L.
I'm Heidi. I'm a 3L.
I'm Veronica. I'm a 2L.
Okay, I'll start talking. So actually, I started kind of working on this project my 1L summer as my 1L summer job, working as a research assistant for Professor Buff. And so I've been thinking about it almost my whole time in law school. But my sort of specific piece here was kind of trying to figure out, so, at, you know, like Professor Buss said, as lawyers, as a legal institution, how do we affect change? So my component was kind of to identify pieces of the law that kind of already support some of the foster care reform efforts that foster care advocates are advocating for, and kind of present a way that advocates might use that already existing law to argue for reform. And what I mean by that is there's lots of ways in all different states that the law kind of already imposes support obligations on parents, especially in the family law context. For youth past the age of majority, as defined in the foster care context, which is 18. We all know, you know, probably most of us anyway, know that we don't necessarily become adults at the age of 18. We're supported by our parents into adulthood. And there's lots of ways the law reflects this, but the foster care system doesn't reflect this. So I'll give you kind of an overview of the kind of arguments I've made and kind of an example. For example, there are states where child support, the age of minority for child support purposes, extends up to 21. So an example of the, you know, identifying that law and making it into a useful argument would be to say, well, okay, if in particular state, I'll use the state of Utah for an example. The state of Utah allows courts discretion to order child support for parents up to the age of 21. However, the age of the age at which foster care jurisdiction terminates for those youth is 18 or graduation from high school. So there's an argument right there. If we define dependence and minority for kids in the family court setting to the age of 21, why don't we apply the same definition in the foster care context? Another area where there's like discrepancy between the foster care system and what states are doing in other contexts is the area of insurance, healthcare insurance. So there's like sweeping reform in the healthcare insurance context right now in many states, where states are passing laws saying that insurance carriers have to maintain coverage for dependents up to the age of 25, 26, even 30 in the state of New Jersey. So in states where that kind of health care coverage is mandated, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to then adhere to this very strict age line of 18 for a foster youth. Because clearly the state is identifying an ongoing need for parental support for youth in certain contexts. Why can we not sort of generalize that to foster youth? In addition, I sort of looked at ways that courts will impose support obligations, family courts. For example, in a lot of states, courts have jurisdiction to impose support obligations on parents when kids are going to college. That's also sort of a way that you can argue by analogy that the foster care system should extend support obligations, or at least extend jurisdiction, at least up through college age. And then finally, I looked at, so for example, in Utah, courts have jurisdiction to impose support obligations for college through 21. It makes sense then that they would retain jurisdiction over foster youth up to that age. And then finally, in the context of adult disabled children, there's almost every state, either by statute or by common law, allows a court to order ongoing parental support for children who are disabled, even though they've reached the age of majority, even though they're adults. And this sort of reflects a change in the in the structure, in the way that courts conceive of independence, it sort of changed from a notion of an age at which we reach adulthood to a notion of sort of a set of behaviors that we exhibit to show that we're adults. So we show we're adults by being able to support ourselves and take care of ourselves. And courts are starting to recognize this by imposing support obligations on parents when their children are not able to support themselves or maintain themselves or take care of themselves. This sort of also lends support to foster care reform efforts, either to extend jurisdiction to an age where kids are more able to support themselves, but also to, it also lends support to the argument that foster youth should not be transitioned from care until they display these behaviors that courts have already identified as the behaviors which indicate adulthood. So that's, I'm not sure if this makes sense, but that's kind of what I've been focusing on, and sort of the general thrust of it is there are all different ways that courts already recognize that age isn't really what makes us an adult. It's really a set of behaviors. And for most people, the process of aging into adulthood is going to be different. It's going to be sort of a give and take, and it's not going to happen automatically at 18. So then my role is to find the ways that the courts and legislatures have already recognized this and sort of say, hey, let's foster care system, let's get consistent with what the rest of the courts are already doing, and let's listen to the urgings of foster care advocates around the country.
Hi, everyone. Heidi's section, as you heard, focuses more on support after the age of 18. And my section, and also a few other students, focuses on sort of what can happen to better prepare youth for aging out, to help them so that they will be able to live independently once they're out on their own. And right now, the sort of dominant paradigm is to have independent living programs, which start usually around the age of 16, and youth learn job skills or job hunt skills, all sorts of things like that. But what my section is focusing on is sort of what can the foster care system, including the child welfare agencies, caregivers and courts, do even well before that kind of programming starts. Because as I said, it often comes later in the teen years. And realistically, we're expecting youth to age out and to be able to make decisions on their own and to take responsibility, have a sort of adult identity formed. Then the attention to that development into adulthood can't start age 16. It has to start earlier. Realistically, social science, psychology, our kind of conventional wisdom tells us that you can't just start the kid at 16 and say, now you're going to learn how to be an adult in 2 years or in 3 years. So I focused on how the system could better address the needs of younger youth. And there are three sort of general barriers that come up all the time, and which sort of prevent optimal attention to developmental needs of younger youth. And the first one is just that the child welfare system is just not focused on this need. The system is focused on pushing permanency goals, often adoption. It's focused on safety, which obviously is a very valid concern. But so the developmental needs of youth in care often take the back burner. And so that's one problem, just sort of a lack of focus. The second problem is that youth in foster care often are subject to restrictions that, you know, a youth who lives with her parents just doesn't have to deal with. There are a lot of liability concerns when the state's the parent. Caregivers have a lot of liability concerns too. So one thing that happens a lot is that there are very strict house rules, either in individual caregiver homes or in group homes. Anecdotally, youth are prevented from talking on the phone, receiving mail, or their mouths opened. They're often restricted in their participation in outside activities, such as after-school activities at school. One place I went to for anecdotes was the Children's Law Center of Los Angeles. And they collected numerous anecdotes from youth who are in care about how these restrictions, mostly motivated by liability concerns, were placed in their life. And you know, there are examples of a child who couldn't attend a church event because all the adult chaperones hadn't had a background check yet. So, or we're maybe never going to have one. But at any rate, there's this phenomenon where liability concerns overwhelm the child's developmental interest. And so there's this overly strong focus on liability over developmental needs. And the third thing that happens that kind of prevents optimal developmental experiences is just that the way that the system works is sometimes disorganized. Kids are often in many different placements. It's hard to, say, make friends and maintain sustained relationships if you're constantly moving from school to school or placement to placement. So so those are the kind of three problems, and my section is sort of how trying to think about how those can be overcome. One thing that I that was kind of different when I was doing work for this project from all other law school projects that I've done is that my research was very different. One thing that I did is I did a lot of research into educational and developmental theory, which makes a pretty strong case that that in order to develop these skills we want to see in adults, sort of ability to take responsibility, ability to set goals and follow through, you really do have to start young. Youth do need adult support. And they also need to have interactions with peers. It's just that's how we develop our identity. We kind of try on identities. We see how our peers react, and then we maybe try something else. So restrictions, that keep someone from hanging out with friends or talking on the phone really do have a detrimental effect. So the question is what to do about this. It's kind of, I'm not, advocating necessarily programming, although programming would be great, more experiences for youth. The first step is to see, how to take away the barriers that are already there. And because our project is really court-focused, it seems like courts might be the answer. I'm not sure how familiar you are with child welfare courts, but once a youth has a permanency plan, which has a goal, which is something like either return to parents, adoption, independence sometimes, there are periodic hearings in court where sort of the permanency plan is evaluated. Is this the right thing? This would be a great opportunity for the court to monitor how the system's doing at, not letting these liability concerns overwhelm a need to address developmental needs of the youth in their care, and how the child welfare system is doing at affirmatively addressing these needs. And so my section is kind of written with courts and advocates as an audience. And one thing that courts can do is just engage kids in conversation. Ask them, what are you doing in school? Ask them, who are your friends? Ask them questions like that to bring this into court. We think that bringing these issues into court will have a major effect. Now, most states don't have, much of a legislative basis for this. California has passed a law which recognizes as a right of all foster care youth to participate in extracurricular activities. They also have the right to talk on the phone, see siblings. Now, in a case like that, there's an easy hook for an advocate. The advocate just says, okay, look, you know, this is in the statute. We have to make sure this is happening. So I think that's a little bit easier. And there is evidence that, at least in Los Angeles County, according to someone I spoke with from the Children's Law Center, that judges are really starting to ask these questions since that legislation was passed. But even even outside of California, there are statutory hooks in the authorizing statutes for the courts, which an advocate can draw on or which a judge can draw on to say, like, look, this is something we're supposed to be addressing. We are supposed to be concerned about developmental needs, not just safety, not just permanency. And it is certainly, I think, especially for older teenagers, it is really a struggle because sometimes the safety goal is at odds with a developmental need. You know, talking with so many times your friends might not always be best for your safety interests. But courts are good at balancing these kinds of things. You know, caseworkers may not be so good at balancing them, but that's what courts do, and it seems like it's the best location. But there is one more problem, and the problem is that at current practice, in most places, youth do not go to court, which is a major problem if we want courts to be asking youth about what their lives are like, about whether their caseworker is seeking out, you know, developmental experiences, that kind of thing. So another thing that I argue is that Mary Lovejoy's section, is that it's a developmental benefit for youth to participate in court. So that's something that if youth are to be prepared to live as adults, then this is going to be an important experience for them, participating in their permanency planning isn't just a due process concern. It's also something that allows them to become adults. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I just regarding both our sections.
Sure.
I just, one comment that occurs to me that I didn't mention when I was talking is, when you're talking about these issues, like developmental issues and what's kind of normal or normative, you know, normative yeah. developmental process, and what states are doing in the family court context, the reason that those matter in the foster care context, the reason that they're powerful in terms of argument, is because the state has stepped in and cut off the parental relationship. So there's this big question, and that's one of the things that we look at, is what duty does the state then owe these children because it has interfered with the relationship that the, you know, people who are not in the foster care system have. And that's sort of where the power of the arguments comes in, because the state has taken on a burden, taken on the responsibility of caring for the children. And, you know, I guess what we're trying to argue is they can't then shun what responsibilities that parents would be imposed with in all other contexts.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one reason I think also to look to science is because, and sort of social science, is because maybe the state knows what Heidi said, that it's stepped in, so it has this responsibility, but it can kind of say, well, we're really worried about, you know, cost or liability, so this is less important, but kind of saying this isn't just conventional wisdom. There's actually, you know, empirical clinical evidence helps. I thought of my section as kind of like a Brandeis brief, you know, this is not just something that we think would be a good idea. It's something that, given that the state stepped in, is really necessary for the state to do.
What Heidi was saying is actually a really nice tie-in to my section, which is, so the state has stepped in and cut off all these ties to family relationships and assumed a custodial relationship with the youth. So what form of federal constitutional rights do they owe these youth? And sort of the background constitutional structure is that, just in general, there's no constitutional right to be protected by the government or to have the government give you services. But in certain circumstances, when the government does something and some affirmative act, they then take on responsibilities. sort of the three really important Supreme Court cases. The first one dealt with prisoners. So when the state puts people in prison, they have to also give them medical care. They can't just put them in prison and then, you know, they have duties of care, such as attending to their medical needs. The next one was about institutionalized individuals. People are in mental health facilities that are state-run. The state owes them a duty to medical care, but also to minimally adequate training. So if someone who's institutionalized in a state institution could receive training that would allow them to operate without injuring themselves, but the state is instead just restraining them all day because it's easier than trying to teach them anything, and they're just having them in physical restraints, that the state owes them a constitutional duty to provide them with that minimal training that would allow them not to have to be restrained all day. And then the third case dealt with children's rights. It was a case brought by a youth who was abused by his father, his natural father, and died. And there was a caseworker who knew that the abuse was going on, or sort of suspected, and the kid had been in the hospital a lot, and they took him into temporary custody for a little bit, but the state never officially took the child into custody or into foster care. And the child died from abuse of his father, and the court held that the state didn't owe the child this duty of care because the child was in the natural parents. It was a private harm, the natural father, he was still with the natural father. But they mentioned in a footnote that it would be a very different scenario had the child been entered into foster care, because then the state would have this sort of custodial relationship. And then from there, all the lower courts, appellate courts that have addressed this issue, have held that the state, when a state takes a child into foster care, they do owe the child a general right of protection. And some of the specific cases have dealt with medical care and case planning. The state has to investigate allegations of abuse by foster parents. The state has to investigate foster parents before they place a child there to make sure that they're going to be safe. So there already exists sort of this lower court, appellate court case law dealing with lots of general rights of foster youth. And what my section was looking at is sort of the boundaries of this are still very much in flux, but how can this help youth who are aging out, and what rights do youth who are in the teenage years, what rights do they have to case planning or preparation for adulthood that would allow them to, that would prevent injury upon discharge? So if a youth is being discharged without any sort of planning for housing or education, no job training, they're going to have no medical care the instant that they turn 18, and there's nothing being done to sort of prevent what is going to be some obvious injuries at the age of 18, whether they really had a constitutional right to some of those services. Part of what made this interesting, I think, was as part of this project, was trying to look at the audience that it was for. So it's one thing to just sort of advocate in the abstract this constitutional right, but then how would that come about? And I think there are two ways that I was sort of looking at. One would be advocates on the individual level that might be representing a foster youth saying, this foster youth isn't receiving these services. They're constitutionally entitled to these services. Another would be sort of a class action to be brought more by like a nonprofit that's looking at the big picture and saying, both youth in and out of care, we have these youth who are out of care who are all homeless now, and then we have these youth in care who aren't getting any sort of planning for their discharge from foster care, and bringing a class action to change sort of on a statewide level. So I think that there are sort of two ways that this can continue to expand. There's a lot of sort of problems that come up with this, just because anytime you're expanding your constitutional right, there's obviously going to be differences. Causation is going to be something that's going to be an issue for courts to deal with. If you become homeless the day that the state discharges you, it seems pretty obvious that you have a claim if they just show up one day and say, pack your bags, get out of your foster home. But if you become homeless maybe 2 years down the road, it's going to be a little bit more interesting to sort of look at causation and what did the state do or not do to prepare you for that.
The topic that I focused on was kind of extending court jurisdiction, and I'm also going to talk a little bit about the right of reentry, which was Katie's section. So I'm just going to start with explaining what extended court jurisdiction and right of reentry are. So in 19 states, when a youth turns 18, the court says, okay, you're no longer under our care, you're an adult, go be an adult. And that's it. There's no services given, there's no help given, like, you're just on your own. And so, for example, a state like that would be, an excellent example of this is Texas. And the reason Texas is an excellent example, part of my research was a 50-state survey. The reason Texas is an excellent example was because it was the only state where I could not find explicitly in the statute when court jurisdiction ends. That doesn't mean it's not there, I just could not find it. So it's not even, as far as I can find, in the statutory code that when you turn 18, you're just out on your own. You just are. So that's kind of like what court jurisdiction is about. So what we want is for states to extend court jurisdiction at least through the age of 21. And what that does is just kind of provide some general oversight. So in New York, a child can say, yes, I'd like to remain under the jurisdiction of the court until I turn 21. And when I think about these issues, primarily, I think about my little brother. My brother and sister are adopted, and my brother has some learning disabilities. So if he was in foster care, he would not be one of the kids who's doing well all the time. He would be one of the kids that needs a little extra help, might be a little bit of a challenge, might want to wring his neck every once in a while. Like, that kind of kid is the kid that I'm thinking about when we're doing this. So if you had asked my brother, when you turn 18, you can not have to do anything that has anything to do with our household, you get to be an adult, he would have shut out the door. And 2 weeks later, he would have been like, can you please let me back in? And that's kind of what right of reentry is about. So but based on the 50-state survey research that I have in front of me, I think Arkansas is the only state that does allow kind of a right of reentry. So once you leave, you can come back for services. And so services would be like job training, help me pay my rent, and Florida. And Florida and Arizona. So you have these extra services. Well, again, I think of my brother, the problem child. So you have this caseworker who's dealt with this person who's been a pain in the butt for the past 6 years, and they come to you and say, hey, I really need some help. I'd really like some help with my rent. And this person might have a 20-person caseload. Do they really have an incentive to help this person? Like, do they really have, like, is it really in their heart that they just really want to go out of their way and find help for this child? Maybe. That would be great if they aren't burned out. But if not, then there's no one there overseeing to make sure that when this child came back and said, I really need these services, that they're actually getting them. And that's why extending court jurisdiction is important, because that gives that additional element of oversight that can compel the state to provide those services. So say it's that problem child. Well, the problem child hopefully has an attorney. A lot of states have some sort of provision that gives the child legal representation. And so they can go to their lawyer, and the lawyer can go to court and say, well, they said they were giving them rent money, but they didn't. Then the court can say, well, you need to give them the rent money, or I'm going to hold you in contempt. And it's just kind of like that big stick that is still there, but it also just gives a little bit of legitimacy. So that's kind of like why court jurisdiction and the right of reentry are important. I was going to just go ahead and kind of like mention good states and bad states, in my view, whether or not they're really good states and bad states. But like examples of good and bad practices. So Texas, bad state, can't find your statue. like driving me nuts. But an example of what I would define as a good state would be Illinois, because it extends court jurisdiction to the age of 21, but it doesn't have any restrictions associated with it. So a lot of states will extend court jurisdiction if you are in a vocational program, if you remain in some sort of educational something. So if you're getting your GED or if you're in college, you know, oh, we'll extend court jurisdiction, we'll give you services in those instances because you're doing what you need to be doing. Again, I think of my little brother. Okay, so basically the kids that are doing the best continue to receive services. So the kids who are struggling a little bit, and maybe they failed all their classes last semester but PE, would be kicked out. And that seems kind of problematic because if Forsyth and Fiore meet my brother, you obviously can't tell him that I told you neither. but like, you mean, if you think about it, so these individuals who really need help and who have been put at a severe disadvantage by being in care, so it's something like estimating like kids who've been in care, I think it's something like 2 years, they lose 2 years in their educational background just because they get placed from here to here to here and they have to keep changing schools. So they're already at a severe disadvantage. But we don't want to help them because they're not doing a great job. But then that turns into, oh, well, now you're not in school anymore. You don't get to receive any more services. So now I don't have any more assistance with my rent. I don't have any more tuition assistance. And if there's no right for reentry, then what am I going to do to really, like, bring things together? And we watched a movie in the class, and there was one, it's, like, not a movie, a documentary in the class, and there was one individual who, she's, like, the lead here in New York, and they ended up having to go back on to public assistance because they weren't able to sustain. She had two children and her boyfriend, like, they just weren't able to sustain themselves and keep going forward without a little extra help. And it would be nice if they could go back to that system and say, hey, you know, I thought I knew everything, but I don't, and I just need some help. And so part of what I did was draft legislation, because I know how to draft legislation. And so I tried to find the good states and kind of copy their parts of their legislation, and we're doing proposals for changes within federal statutes. So states receive federal funding for kids in foster care up until the age of 18, and we'd like to see that extended through the age of 21. So now the state extends care through 21, that extra 3 years they're paying all on their own. And there are 12 states, depending on how you count, who extend jurisdiction through 21 without any restrictions. So they're just paying for it on their own. And so that's kind of like what would be great if this could happen. Professor West was on was on a conference call last week that I sat on, and there are a lot of different groups who are interested in this particular topic, and Representative Danny Davis's office, who's a representative from Illinois, would like to see changes put into the legislation to just provide more care for these kids. So I think that's basically what I was going to say.
If anybody is wondering about like where the 21 age comes from, maybe?
So I think that, okay, well, 21 age comes for me because that's where where the states have general, like that seems kind of like the general consensus. There are a few states who extend to 19 if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. There are like North Dakota is at 20. My inclination is Professor Buss would like it longer than 21, like 25. Realistically, I don't think the government's going to do that.
There's a notion of what's politically sellable,
right,
the idea is that there's a reason to think that the world could move to 21. If you come out saying it should be 25, which seems to match more with what we see the rest of the world experience and what we know about development, there's a risk of being thought to be not so credible. But there is a intention to capture the fact that we're recommending extension at least to 21 as a way of kind of trying to finesse that for someone who would be open. Look, if we really want to take this where the arguments take us, this would be beyond 21. I just say a couple things really quickly. I will promise to keep my mouth shut. But you all talk about sections, and you might wonder what sections mean. So the idea is one of the things, there are a couple work products that we are producing that we are looking forward to sharing with anybody out in the world who's interested in this issue. And there are a lot of people who one way or another interested in the issues, which is what is right now an enormous document we're calling the Chicago Protocol, where everybody has taken a particular piece of the issue and sort of piece of the legal puzzle and drafted something, and that's being integrated into a single document, and that will be shared with the world. And we're looking for a way to do it electronically as well, because there's a notion that getting the greater details is really valuable for some audiences, but you don't want to scare away other audiences. And so the idea is lots of appendices that have model briefs and model legislation and the like. And the other thing people have done is that they've been involved in a 50-state survey. Veronica specifically looked at one issue and looked at all the states, but the whole workshop has divvied up the state to try to get basic information so that that also can be shared. People out there working on this issue want to know what's, you know, is there an example of where it works? What's the best legislation out there? We've tried to engage that discussion. So I just wanted, since you were all talking about sections, I thought I should explain the sections.
The only other thing I was going to add is that when I'm talking about 21, I'm talking about the age when court jurisdiction ends, not necessarily when services end. And so, for example, in Georgia, I'm going to mess up all the ages, but basically, like, if you're in school, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, they'll provide financial support through the age of 26, based on the person I talked to. And, I mean, their program for providing just tuition and stuff like that, it's something like, they model it off of, I think, Georgia State's tuition, they make sure, so whatever the federal government gives you, fine, whatever, and then they'll give you the rest, and then after the federal government stops giving it to you, then they give you that aid, and so that's just one service. So, like, services, I think that this age I suggested in the model legislation for Danny Davis' office is like 23 in Florida, I think extends through services through 23, and that's what, and I noted that that's what I was basing that age off of. So that's kind of like a separate thing. But that was the last thing I wanted to mention, I think.
Didn't talk about Chief and all. Did I just mention it? Chapin Hall, like part of this flows from the Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago has been doing.
It's a research institute.
Chapin Hall. Yeah, Chapin Hall. Right, that hall is called Chapin, and that hall does research. So part of this flows from. The research institute has been looking at the outcomes of foster youth in three Midwestern states, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And part of the push for extending jurisdiction to 21, part of it comes from this study, because the study compared Illinois, where jurisdiction, you know, the good state, where jurisdiction continues to 21, to Wisconsin and Iowa. Makes me sad. In my research, I've learned Wisconsin is a very bad state. but it seems to be changing a little bit as a result of Chapin Hall, which is good. But anyway, in the comparison, the research coming out of Chapin Hall does suggest that youth who are allowed to remain in foster care until the age of 21 seem to do a lot better on a lot of measures of, you know, ability to support themselves, finding jobs, finding housing, staying out of jail, those sort of things, than youth who are forced to exit from care at age 18. And so part of our arguments kind of flow from that, trying to kind of figure out, well, how, as within sort of the legal construct, how can we, you know, how can, as lawyers, we also sort of affect this sort of positive change? And in extending court jurisdiction is one way to make sure that the supports and resources that kids get when they stay in care until 21 keep coming until the age of 21.
So. Does anyone have any questions? For any of us, or Professor Buss? And there are lots of foster care members in the audience that I'm sure he knows. Yeah.
Workshop.
Sorry.
Yeah, I think this question mostly gets to what you were talking about, Heidi. But Professor Buss briefly mentioned political stability with regard to getting the statutes changed for the better. And I just wonder what kind of information there is out there about, it seems to me the biggest obstacle to these types of changes is cost. And what kind of information is there out there about the cost of changing something from 18 to 21? And more particularly, is there a compelling story out there that says, because in my opinion, I think the costs are there either way. You either spend them up front, or you spend them on dealing with homelessness, problems with pregnancy, or criminal issue, or whatever comes from injecting people into a world that they're not prepared to be in. Is there a compelling story that says that it's actually cheaper to incur these costs on the front end or the back end, or do people research that kind of thing, or you know, what do we know about that?
Okay, I'm gonna try and answer your question. I did a little bit about the potential cost. So I'm gonna be reading a little bit. So the federal government for each child that was in foster care gave a medium of $15,914 from fiscal year 2001 to fiscal year 2003. Now that's supplemented by the states. So I can't tell you, and apparently there's some sort of pamphlet that's already done something like this, but group in San Francisco, and I haven't looked at it yet. So there is information out there about this. But we can compare that $15,000 number, and that was for two years, with the cost of incarceration per year, which is estimated at $30,929. And the Chapin Hall study does indicate that for individuals who leave care versus 18 or 21, the likelihood of being incarcerated is it increases. And then some other numbers that I don't have on here, but that you have to remember are kind of like just general public assistance. So is it like three extra years providing services for the federal government? So maybe like that's $21,000. So three extra years, $21,000, and then whatever the state supplements. Versus maybe 2 years in jail versus maybe on and off of public assistance for the rest of your life. And then just kind of, when it just look at educational opportunities. So for example, kids can be discharged from care and without a high school diploma or without a GED. They reach 18. There's some states like if you are 18, but within 6 months you're gonna graduate from high school, they'll go ahead and extend jurisdiction. But you could leave care without that minimum basic degree. So if your adults 18 and older with bachelor's degrees earn approximately $51,000 per year. If you have a high school diploma, you earn approximately $28,000 a year, and if you do not have a high school diploma, you earn about $18,000. So you're looking at someone who has a high school diploma, has received those extra services, has gotten the support they need, especially if they've gone on to college and received those extra services to get them into college and get that bachelor's. You're looking at a vast difference in their potential to just their financial capabilities in the future. And that will affect whether or not, if they have three kids, they're going to end up on public assistance, whether or not they're going to need WIC. So, like, my economic arguments aren't very developed, but they are out there, and there are people making them.
Yeah. Can I add something? I think Sarah's point about causation is relevant to this as well, because at some point it's just going to be impossible to quantify the cost, to figure out whether somebody's, you know, incarceration 6 years after they're discharged from care can be traced back to their care or, you know, to their time in care or their lack of training or whatever. And so I think our arguments, we didn't really go into the economics of...
Which the Veronica section does not.
Yeah, right. But I don't think we didn't, like, run any models, for example. And I think part of that is because for this to be politically feasible, it's going to have to be more than just, we can show you a spreadsheet that shows you that this will cost less. You have to also appeal to sort of the moral and ethical understanding of what the state owes to children who it's decided to take into its care. I don't think we're convinced the economic is going to be the only, but there's like a clean economic answer.
Yeah, is it okay if I add something? Well, as I say, this is an issue, a version of that question comes up a lot also in the context of juvenile justice, so issues of how you respond to crime committed by juveniles. And to the extent you can tell, I think it's fair to say that it's very likely to be cost-effective to front-end in the kinds of ways we're talking about here, and in the juvenile justice context, the ways that people know to front-end, partly because the back-end is so shockingly expensive. If you're talking multiple years of incarceration, that alone is such a sort of shocking price tag. But I have learned over time that even to the extent that the argument looks, you know, pretty compelling, it isn't enough to sell this politically. It's sort of striking. You think, wow, you know, for all the other reasons, you can sort of make a case that it's actually going to be cheaper. So there are other reasons. It seems kind of obvious that it might be a better way to go. It's not enough for all sorts of reasons that you can come up with explanations for why. It's not going to be enough to sell it in itself. That being said, if you have people who are generally on board, but they're worried that this is the stumbling block, I think it's very helpful and it will be very useful, even though there are limitations to getting more sophisticated. Not within what we could do. I mean, what we offer is a kind of crude version. No offense, but sort of in light of what we're focused on, to say there's every reason to think this is also cost effective. I think there is every reason to think it's likely to be cost effective. Although I agree with Katie, you can't insist that is going to be so. It's also complicated by the fact that children who grow up in foster care have other reasons that life is going to be hard, even if they're very supported because they've had a really hard start. So they may be expensive kids any way you cut it, right, as adults. But I do think it's important to recognize that it's a piece of the picture, but it's never going to control decision-making in this area, at least based on what I've experienced in this world to date.
I have a question. For your project, were you able to research any primary sources? And by that, I mean interviewing foster children, adults, over the age of 21, and I asked that question because I'm 33 and I was a foster child all of my life, and I just like to know if you were able to get any real life accounts from adults who were foster children.
Part of how this project started was last year Professor Buss had a conference and there were all sorts of different attendees, but there were former foster care youth in the room, and there was one man in particular who was very adamant about just leave us alone, like let us go and let's do what we can do it, and like just don't restrict us and we can make it. But there were a couple other people in the room who seemed to, I mean, my sense was that they did feel like extra support is helpful. And then the entire, like our protocol document before it's being published, there are judges and at least one former foster care youth, two former foster care youth who are looking at, I mean, not every section applies to all people, like they're different actors within those different sections of the document. So, but yes, some, I mean, so interviews, like one-on-one interviews, I don't know that anyone...
Well, other parts of the project have had some of that, and should have more of it. It's very important that we do it. There's no question.
Because there were some things that were mentioned that were true. I found some things not to be true in my case. But as far as, I think you mentioned that foster children are really not at the courtroom when their cases are being heard. And I never went to any of my court hearings, except the very first one that established me as a permanent ward of the state of Illinois. And after that, I never went to court again. I don't even know if I had a guardian ad litem, which is someone that is really working for the state, but to advocate for the child.
Right.
And, you know, I'm glad that University of Chicago Law School is taking on this project. Illinois is a better state. You know, our law schools in Texas, in these other questionable states, you know, taking on this project to research this from more of a local level. So, I applaud you.
There, are you asking?
No, I was just saying that.
Okay.
I was commenting.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I would like to, you know, I wonder if other law schools are doing this, but I don't know if you have that answer. But.
There are other law schools that have kind of child advocacy programs. So I think I did, when we split up the states, we each did five states, and of my five states, four had at least one law school, if not more, who had like clinical programs who were doing child advocacy work. Now whether or not they're doing this work.
Yes, so this is one of the things we see. We have in a law school, there are all sorts of limitations about what we could do. One thing we thought we could do, in addition to research on some of the legal issues that people out there doing advocacy day to day don't have a time to is to put together something that we can put in the hands of experts, people in institutions. And one of our list of institutions are clinical programs that involve some kind of child advocacy that focuses on issues of youth and foster care. Mm-hmm. You know,
Another thing I just want to comment on is the media. I remember, and I don't remember what year, but it was in the 90s, mid-90s, where there was a special on one of the major broadcast stations on adopted children. And it might have been an hour, maybe even a two-hour special. And I don't see the same type of media attention to foster children. And I just, you know, I felt kind of like, well, what about, you know, our issues? You know, and at that time, I might have been around 24, 25. And it seems like if there was more attention brought to it for the public to think about it, you know, there might be some improvements in the, you know, the legislative system.
They're getting our protocol to a real challenge, right? Usually people hear about these issues, they think they agree it's a problem. It's not why these things work for you. It concerns people, and people are pretty oblivious to the issue.
Right. And in my own issue, I think at the age of 8 or 9, someone wanted to adopt me, but my mother had not released her parental rights or something like that. But she had not done what they had wanted her to do for her to get me back in her care. And I always think about it as well, you know, as far as looking at the child's best interest, what can the state be compelled to do to, you know, I don't know anything about the right of a parent to say, well, even though I'm not going to do what you say, you know, you need me to do, I'm not going to relinquish my parental rights, you know. And so it's a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering how the U.S. practices compare to those in other industrialized countries. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that would help sell it politically.
This is not something they go on. I have a look at that if you're interested. Yeah, so exactly. I'd say as far as that goes, since we're, you know, la 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 la, they do it differently somewhere else, it must be worse. But it's interesting, of course, for those of us who are working in the field, we're very interested in knowing what other countries do. And I've actually found it very hard to get good information beyond basically the countries that look the most like us. I'm really interested in parts of the world where the concept of family and the role that the law plays in family structure are very different. What do they do about these kinds of issues? But the countries that look the most like us obviously have a lot we can learn from as well. What you see in at least the parts of Europe that I've been able to sort of either met someone so I could really have a conversation about it that goes beyond me because you're fine reading or things I've been able to find reading is that our whole rights-based structure is somewhat aberrant in that to that extent. There's much more of a notion that children, much more willingness to recognize needs, claims of children as sort of rights that the law protects. And then flowing from that, less by way of sorting in terms of, you know, this rights of parents, rights of children, when they diverge and the like, and a system of care that also makes fewer distinctions between children, teens who are offenders, and children, teens who need, say, assistance of some sort. So it's an attractive model, and it's very needs-based. It's somewhat unattractive in the eyes of lawyer people like me, because it is quite paternalistic and invasive. So the state plays, and there seems to be broader support for state playing a larger, less questioned role in making some of these decisions. So that's sort of the bad news. The good news is the kind of intervention is a more benign to helpful intervention. But there's some thought that there's a movement in the rest of it, sort of in those parts of the world, toward more of a rights-focused approach, more American approach.
Since
they did brag about themselves, they really have done tremendous impressive work on things like, for example, Veronica not mentioning. Well, it's not just that the Danny Davis office is doing this, but the AAGE is working on this. It's actually talked a number of times to Veronica to get input about what the legislation should look like. That's fair. Don't fight it. So, in each in different way, had opportunities to sort of figure out what the world looks like out there in terms of how to think about how the pieces will might be able to plug into what people who are on the ground working day to day are doing, which is, I'm very excited to be part of.